Martin Handley.
Thank you very much, Jill. Well, hello and welcome to this grand old man of concert halls, where in the first of tonight's proms, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales returns for the first time this season since its triumphant contribution to the mega blockbuster of Havergal O'Brien's Gothic Symphony. This evening, France is at the heart of the orchestra's programme, with its principal conductor, the French-Swiss Thierry Fischer, who seems to particularly enjoy his visits to the Royal Albert Hall.
I guess it's the excitement of, first of all, being part of this major BBC festival. And the excitement when you look at the programme, you look at the brochure, you know, every night, you know, this orchestra doing this, and then another new thing, and wow, oh, and this orchestra is doing this. And you're just part of this, I think, extremely creative major event.
The concert ends with a glittering, magical ballet score, which had its premiere in Paris, performed by the Ballet Russe, Stravinsky's Firebird. In the first half of the concert, we have a UK premiere of a string quartet with a difference. French composer Pascal Dusapin's Sixth is played by his great advocate, the Arditti Quartet, alongside whom he adds a symphony orchestra. And to begin, two well-known shorter pieces from the French repertoire. Forêt's Pavane and an overture full of Byronic flair, Berlioz's Le Corsaire. He'd been told by his doctor after the breakup of his first marriage he needed to get away from it all to recover from his physical and nervous exhaustion. The place he chose was Nice, where he stayed in a tower overlooking a glorious view of the Mediterranean. Exhausted or not, the majority of the overture Berlioz wrote there could hardly be more frenetic. Berlioz first called it La Tour de Nice, for obvious reasons, but later changed the title to reflect the piratical writings of first Fenimore Cooper and then Byron. Admittedly, Byron's poem The Corsair fascinated Berlioz, but this overture has really far more to do with the atmosphere of Nice and the Mediterranean, as seen from Berlioz's tower. Well, the leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Leslie Hatfield, is already on stage, and she's tuned the orchestra. A very full platform and a very full hall it is here. And now coming onto the platform, Thierry Fischer, to conduct Berlioz's overture, Le Corsaire. 20th Piratical Swagger in Berlioz's Overture Le Corsair, performed to open this prom live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thierry Fisher. And he's staying on the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall to conduct Forêts Pavanes. Surprisingly erotic take on the dance. Thank you. posturing and flirting on some elusive dance floor. Forêts Pavane, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thierry Fisher. And the first thing he did was to bring Juliet Bowser, the flautist, to her feet. Pavane was first heard at 1902 Proms, and a real lucky dip of a concert, with pieces by 15 other composers, as well as Forêt. Well, now, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, we've reached tonight's UK premiere of a piece which you might think has stepped out of a chamber prom up at Cadogan Hall, Pascal Dussapin's String Quartet No. 6, which he calls Hinterland, until you notice that its subtitle is Hapax, for String Quartet and Orchestra. Well, Dussapin's now in his mid-50s. He studied with Messiaen, then with Xenakis. And like Xenakis, he was drawn to the ancient past, his sound world suggestive of it, if also intrinsically modern and raw. He's always been prolific. In the 90s, he became amazingly so, writing a whole series of large-scale works, including four string quartets for his enthusiastic advocates, the Arditi Quartet. Well, his now seven quartets cover pretty much his entire composing career, and so they trace his musical development. The sixth, which we hear tonight, was completed in 2009. It's the exception in the cycle, as I say, in that it also requires a full symphony orchestra. It was Erwin Arditi who asked Pascal Dussapin to write such a piece, and I asked him earlier how that came about.
We have some pieces with quartet and orchestra, but actually there are very few. And I thought that this sort of genre could be extended. Pascal is a composer we had a very long relationship with, going back to his first string quartet and his early string trio. And through almost all of his quartets, we gave the premiere. And so when we have this relationship of more than 20 years, I thought it would be a good idea to ask Pascal if he had ideas for such a thing.
Pascal, listening to it just now, in a sense, there feels that there's a competition to use the same material between the quartet and the orchestra. Is that right?
Yes, of course. It's in fact not a competition, but it's like a body divided by two hearts, you know, different. And in a sense, for me, it's a human situation. The music is becoming more and more always like a nature, a human nature. With the numbers of the musician, I chose a light orchestra.
And it's not just one quartet and then the orchestra, because you actually take a second string quartet,
yes,
from,
yeah,
the principal players,
yes,
in the orchestra as,
yeah,
well. So there are lots of layers.
Yeah,
of
it's like a contamination, in fact, you know, in a sense. The principe is going inside the orchestra.
Thinking about that, the title of the quartet is Hinterland.
Yeah.
Is that the orchestra? Is the orchestra the hinterland of the quartet, or is it an entirely different...
Yes, it's exactly the concept, in fact. Hinterland, it's the arrière-pays, it's a German name, but it works too in English, I think.
The land behind.
The land behind, you know. And it's a philosophical concept, very German. I'm always returning to the string quartet, you know. In fact, this is my own hinterland.
Erwin, there must be a lot of performing challenges for the quartet when you're playing with an orchestra. And of course, not least, you have the constrictions, if you like, of having a conductor beating at you. What does this involve, playing with an orchestra, for you? What are the differences?
Well, generally, I don't like conductors. I think I've gone down in history.
How many musicians do?
Not liking conductors, but I'm growing to like them more and more these days. And certainly the one we have tonight is a wonderful one. But no, I think this is not the problem. The problem mainly for the quartet is actually to be heard, because the moment you have a backing of all those bodies behind us soaking up the sound, and the Royal Albert Hall where the sound evaporates, it's quite difficult to be heard. But in saying that, I think the piece works very well. It's written very cleverly, and it's something I reminded Pascal a few times when he was writing the piece. Please make sure you can hear the string quartet.
Yeah.
And he's written two or three sections, two large sections, where the quartet is alone.
Yes.
But playing these sections, to me, they almost sound orchestral. They're not solistic. They're very much thick quartet writing, basically.
It's not a concerto for string,
yeah,
quartet.
Exactly. It's a string quartet. Yeah. This is why the title amused me at first, yeah, calling it a string quartet with an orchestra.
Yeah.
But it really is. Mm. It's always a challenge to play a piece with an orchestra. I think that's why I like these pieces so much, because we always like to rise to challenges.
Erwin Arditi, and before him Pascal Dussapin. It's the fourth performance already of this piece, by the way. It had its world premiere in Lucerne over 2 years ago. Well, the composer Julian Anderson's joined me in the box. Julian, could you just tell us something about Pascal Dussapin's style? What we're going to hear?
Well, this is a composer who's very inclusive in his musical language. He uses the most familiar sounds, like, very simple diatonic modes, very simple melodic figures, very clear rhythmic figures, as well as very complicated ones and very unusual tunings and so on. In this piece, the harmonic language is very, very focused. You'll hear quite quickly that it zones in on a particular area and explores it very thoroughly. And because the pitch and the harmony is so clear, he can do all sorts of fantastical things with the interaction of the string quartet and the orchestra. It really is, even though the composer, I think, doesn't like it to be thought of as a concerto, I certainly hear it that way. The two are vying with each other for the same material and clambering over each other in all sorts of competitions.
He makes it very clear that he thinks of it as a quartet, but it is very difficult not to see it as a kind of sinfonia concertante in a way, isn't it?
Really? Absolutely, yeah. And I think that, obviously, this is a tribute to the strength and power of the Arditi Quartet's playing, that he can pit them viably against an orchestra, but it is a reduced orchestra, of course. It's only double wind, one harp, small string section, really, and no percussion. And I think that's to get the balance right and to make them interact better with the quartet. But he never uses that much percussion, this composer.
And it's almost the hardest hall you could imagine, making this piece work in this kind of hall in such a large space.
It will be fascinating to see how this piece, which I've heard only on a radio recording before now, balances out in the Albert Hall. But I think that the position of the quartet is such that it'll work very, very well. And as I say, this is a very full-sounding quartet. They have a very wide range of dynamics.
Thank you very much, Julian. Well, the scene changed. The move has taken place. The inner ring round Thierry Fischer's podium is reserved for the members of the Arditi Quartet. And as Julian was saying, it's a reduced string section, double wind and two horns. And here come the Arditi Quartet, Erwin Arditi and Asha Taskaskian, violins, Ralph Eilert's viola, Lucas Fell's cello, followed by Thierry Fischer, joining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to give the UK premiere of Pascal Dussapin's Quartet No. 6, Hinterland, Hapax, for quartet and orchestra.
Thank you.
That was the UK premiere, live on Radio 3, of Pascal Dusepin's Quartet No. 6, Hinterland, Hapax for Quartet and Orchestra, given here in the Royal Albert Hall as part of tonight's BBC Prom by the Arditti Quartet, Irvin Arditti and Ashot Tsakis, Jan Violins, Ralph Eilert's Viola, Lucas Fell's Cello, with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thierry Fisher. And down the steps comes Pascal Dusepin, shoulder-length hair, tall, slender figure, full of energy, embracing Thierry Fisher, and big hugs for the Ardittis, who he's known for, well, he says 30 years now. As for string quartets, well, I asked him whether he was thinking about his eighth. He said yes, he was. Irvin Arditti suggested jokingly he might try thinking about it with chorus. It was a joke, but who knows? What he is doing, Pascal Dusepin, is writing a new violin concerto for Boston to be performed in 2013. And of course, it wasn't just one quartet. There was another quartet, the principals of the string sections of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Leslie Hatfield, the leader, Naomi Thomas, principal second violin, Jurgen Frost, viola, and John Center, cello. Back come the Arditti Quartet. I must say that music does feel vocal at times to me. There are snatches of song running through it, and Dusepin is a very successful opera composer. He's back on the platform applauding the members of the orchestra, who Thierry Fisher gets to stand. Quartet and composer stand together. They're delighted to say they've got a few weeks' holiday, then they're off to Edinburgh doing a Japanese-based programme, Dai Fujikura's Flair, bit of Ravel as well, and then Friedrich Haas Quartet with Electronics in Lucerne. And at 9:15 tonight here on Radio 3, very soon after the end of this concert, you can hear a composer portrait about Pascal Dusepin. In 20 minutes' time, orchestra and conductor turn to the first magical ballet score by a then still unknown young Russian, Stravinsky, his Firebird. But meanwhile, while performers and audience alike enjoy some refreshment, there's time here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, to have a look at various aspects of the season, not least the French connection. So to do that, I've been joined once more by in the Radio 3 box by the composer Julian Anderson. Julian, first up, your impressions of Pascal Dusepin's string quartet with added symphony orchestra.
Well, I maintain, in contradiction to Monsieur Dusepin, that it is indeed a string quartet concerto.
Yeah.
I don't hear it as a solo quartet with orchestra, but since quite often the two are confined to the same range, there's a lot of confusion orally, a deliberate confusion, I should say, between who's playing what. The quartet merges into the orchestra in a way that actually is not so common in concerto scenario, I'd say that. But on the other hand, there are these explosions for the quartet, which he calls exhaustion attempts.
Yes.
Which punctuate the piece, and where the solo quartet takes off on its own. I should say nothing will ever exhaust the Arditti string quartet.
No, it's extraordinary, the sort of ferocity of their energy, isn't it? Really?
Yes, no, well, and the scoring does actually match their sound very, very well. The fact that there's no brass except two horns, who are really used as often in orchestra as part of the wind section, works very well indeed.
He does say that the material which is used by everyone kind of infects first the string quartet of the orchestra and then the entire orchestra, so that the same material does go round and round and round.
Well, it is a very focused piece. I mean, the harmonic area it's focused on is very clearly circumscribed. It doesn't move everywhere. And as I said before, this releases a lot of possibilities for counterpoint and those kinds of things, and echoing devices, changes of register, etc., which can focus simply because he's using only a very limited range of pitches at any one moment.
To me, it almost sounds Northern European. Perhaps one could even say Nordic. Do you hear anything particularly French in the sound of this music?
Well, the mode that he uses in that piece is one which is has eight notes in it to the octave. It's called the octatonic scale, and it's one that's used a lot by Messiaen, though in a very, very different way. Messiaen uses it for a sort of ecstatic contemplation. Here the atmosphere is very definitely tense, and agitated and uneasy, and it has a sort of diminished quality which reminds me somewhat of Sibelius, but then I do know that Dizopan likes Sibelius' symphonies very much, especially the fourth, which is full of tritones and tense intervals like that piece we just heard.
You mentioned Messiaen, Julian. Well, of course, Dizopan did study with him, I think, fairly briefly. He was sort of seriously a pupil of Tanakis. But Messiaen, Boulez, anything of them there, or do you think...
Certainly not, no. I mean, his attendance in the Messiaen class was, from what I understand, fairly brief, and I wouldn't cite Boulez as any kind of influence at all. In fact, Pascal Dizopan, right from the outset, although he was somewhat identified with Xenakis, with whom he did study, frankly, he has stood apart from most of the faction fighting in French musical life. He's an independent figure who's gone his own way quite stubbornly for 30 years. Over that time, the music's gone from being initially very, very dissonant indeed and full of extended techniques and slides and glissandi to being much more stable in pitch, as you just heard. But he's really not that concerned about French musical tradition, I would think, except possibly Berlioz, who I know he's also very interested in.
Yes, yes.
Another outsider figure in his day, it has to be said.
Well, there's a focus this Proms season on French music since 1900, as the Proms marks the 95th birthday of Henri Dutilleux. We've just heard the UK premiere of Dusepin's piece. Well, tomorrow, Emmanuel Paillou with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales gives the London premiere of Marc-André d'Albervie's Flute Concerto. Julian, your article in the Proms Guide asks the question about whether Debussy still colours French music today. Does he? Would you say that about the music of d'Albervie, for example?
I think in the case of Marc-André d'Albervie, there is an influence from Debussy, which would be both in terms of the use of orchestral colour, which I think has certain resemblances to Debussy, but also in the transparency of the music and its fleeting quality. It's particularly close, I would say, to some of the later Debussy, like Je, the wonderful ballet he wrote for Diaghilev, which seems to change direction every few bars. That's something that d'Albervie certainly does do. But on the other hand, you'll hear in the d'Albervie piece also an influence of repetitive music, of minimalist music, and also of the one of the later trends in French music known as spectral music, which is music based on the acoustical properties of sound. Tristan Murail being one of the leaders of that.
He was a teacher of d'Albervie.
He taught him all... I must say, I think Murail's wonderful orchestral piece, Gondwana, will go down a storm here, but actually he's never been played at the Proms. I hope that'll happen soon. Meanwhile, d'Albervie's piece is an expert work for a wonderful flautist and has a really fantastic range of timbres, as you'll hear.
What about Dutilleux himself? Why do you think he seems to be more appreciated outside France?
Funnily enough, I just wrote an article about this question and I've not come to any clear conclusion as to what the answer is. I think Dutilleux's early success with large American symphony orchestras like the Cleveland and the Boston and so on may somewhat have put him outside the ken of the French musical circuit for a curious reason. In fact, very little French contemporary music until quite recently got done on the American orchestral circuit. Boulez, for example, Pierre Boulez, got known there not initially as an orchestral composer, but as an orchestral conductor. And Olivier Messiaen's Tarangalila Symphony was a famous Koussevitzky commission, but actually it didn't get done much in America until much later in the 60s, though it was premiered by Bernstein there in 49. So that I think Dutilleux's success there, which was kind of unique amongst French composers, and very persistent, wonderful pieces like Metabol, which we hear this season as well, and other pieces, Second Symphony, and more recent pieces, The Shadow of Time, for example, Boston Symphony Orchestra Commission. There's been a very persistent following for Dutilleux in America, which I think may have simply meant, unfortunately, that some people in France in charge of things thought, well, we don't need to do Dutilleux. He's being done in America and elsewhere, so that doesn't need us. I'm not sure, but I wonder.
Well, let's hope that in his 95th year, 96th year, he hits 95, that the French will begin to really appreciate the amazing joy of sound of Henri Dutilleux. Julian, for the moment, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, when I'm sitting in the hall during rehearsals for the Proms, I usually see groups of excited tourists being ushered quietly and expertly into a box to take in the atmosphere of the hall and listen to a bit of the music. One of the people who escort those tours is Daryl Bennett.
I'm lucky enough to be the tours and retail manager at the hall, and we take some 28,000 people around the building, and we're often asked by customers on the tours about some interesting facts and figures, some firsts and some quirks as far as the hall and particularly the proms are concerned. The hall opened in 1871, and less than a year later the Royal Choral Society was formed, and the first concert was indeed attended by Queen Victoria. Before the turn of the 20th century, two great luminaries of the operatic world, Adelina Patti and Clara Butt, both made their debuts at the hall, Adelina in 1882 and Clara in 1892, debuting with the Royal Choral Society. The Royal Albert Hall, of course, is synonymous with the proms and the promenade concerts, but even before they came to the hall was a home to some pivotal moments within the classical music genre. One of this year's proms, Verdi's Requiem, actually had its London debut way back in 1875 at the Royal Albert Hall, and in fact conducted by Verdi himself. And that was shortly followed in May 1877 by the Wagner Festival, conducted by the great man himself. We've also had a couple of pop proms in our time. The Beatles and the Rolling Stones famously performed on the same bill in the great pop prom of 1963. And in 1969, the Pop Proms ran for 9 concerts, featuring many of the big names of the day, including Led Zeppelin, Fleetwood Mac, and The Who.
Daryl Bennett from the Royal Albert Hall with some facts and figures about past highlights in this very building. It's amazing, the figures that you see the ghosts when you hear this music. Well, we've a new strand, the BBC Proms, this year. Once a week, a chance to relax after the main concerts you have by heading for the Elgar Room and an informal late-night bar setting where jazz and poetry await. And here's part of last Friday's session. The poet Caroline Bird reading her own work, followed by the Claire James Trio.
This is about that little voice in the back of your head that tells you that it's not going to last, and it's called A Love Song. Long before you tie the knot, divorce moves in. He sits on the naughty step, patting his knees. Crowned in towel, I step out of the shower and he's there, handing me a raffle ticket. He plays kickabout with the neighbourhood kids, chalks crosses on their doors and buys them Big Macs. Socking his fist into the bowl of his hat, he'd kick the gate wide that sunny day in Leeds. My mum was incredulous. She's only 10. She can't possibly have made contact with you. He clocked my young face and handed me his card. Call me when you fall in love. I'm here to help. Perhaps he smelt something in my pheromones, a cynicism rising from my milk teeth. With gum, he stuck notes to Valentine's flowers, tiny life letters in factual grey ink. The future cut two keys for a new couple. On my 21st, divorce took the spare room. He loves to breathe down the spout of the kettle, make our morning coffee taste mature and sad. He waits by the car, slowly tapping tic-tacs down his throat. We've thought about stabbing him, but he's such a talented calligrapher. Our wedding invitations look posh as pearl. He bought us this novelty fridge magnet set, a naked doll with stick-on wedding dresses. Divorce and I sometimes sit in the kitchen, chucking odd magnetic outfits at the fridge. He does the cooking, guarding over the soup, dipping his ladle like a spectral butler. He picks me daisies, makes me mixtapes, whispers, call me D. Next thing, he'll be lifting the veil. After the honeymoon, we'll do up the loft, give Divorce his own studio apartment. We must keep him sweet. My fiancé agrees. Look him in the eye. Subtly hide matches. Remember, we've an arsonist in the house. The neighbours think we're crazy, pampering him like a treasured child, warming his freezing feet. But we sing Divorce to sleep with long love songs.
Thank you.
The Claire James Trio, Claire herself on piano, Stuart Wilson bass, Jim Molyneux drums. And before that, the poet Caroline Bird, recorded at the Proms late event last Friday. Well, the next one takes place this Saturday evening after the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra Prom, Richard Strauss, Walton and Prokofiev. Just the sort of programme it's good to chill out after. And on Saturday morning at 11, we've our free family prom. The Horrible Histories team from CBBC will be entertaining the audience with songs and sketches from their TV series, alongside the Aurora Orchestra and two children's choirs. Well, they've become the envy of their friends as they get to sing with their favourite stars. And the lucky children were rehearsing in London last week.
I'm Richard Frostick, and I'm a musical director of the Music Centre, which includes the Islington and Southwark Music Centres, and I conduct and work with children and young people's choirs. Well, at the moment, we're in the Union Chapel in Islington, a grand, beautiful old chapel, and we are working, it's one of the final rehearsals where we've got all the children and young people together from the Music Centre and from the other schools, the Kids Company schools. And we've got the actors coming in later on, so there's a great buzz, because obviously the children are really looking forward to seeing the actors, their idols. And we're just putting them through their paces, making sure that they know their parts, that they understand that the Albert Hall is a vast space and that they've got to really project.
This is it, so let's just do that imagining bit again. You're in the Royal Albert Hall. 5,500 people are hanging on your every word and looking at you.
My name's Darcy. It's really fun, and it's going to build my experience for doing different things in the future.
Hey, my name is Cristiano. Well, I would really like to meet all the actors, and I'm really happy to learn all the Horrible History songs and sing along as I watch them on TV.
I like learning all the songs and just having a great time.
I'm Sasha from Kids Company, the charity. I'm sort of the music coordinator, and it's just been absolutely amazing to have the opportunity to work with the BBC on such an incredible project, and to have the Horrible Histories involved as well is just awesome for the kids, because they all love the show so much. You know, the kids that we support at Kids Company, you know, they're kids which probably wouldn't have the opportunity to ever perform somewhere like the Royal Albert Hall, so for them it's just absolutely the best day. It will be the best day of their lives probably, so yeah, it's just an amazing opportunity.
Well, I enjoy singing and actually listening, knowing how warm-ups, different warm-ups you do on singing to make you be a good professional singer.
Like going on performance and singing.
The best song is and the first bit.
The past is no longer a mystery. Welcome to Horrible Histories.
Young choristers enjoying the gory bits as they prepare for the Horrible Histories free family prom on Saturday morning at 11, live of course here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. Well, if you've just switched on, welcome to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley. The second half of tonight's first BBC Prom, being given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, just coming back onto the stage now. And they'll be conducted by their principal conductor, Thierry Fisher. The one work on the programme, one of the great ballet scores, Stravinsky's Firebird. Early in his career, he had the good luck to be in the right place at the right time, and a couple of his short orchestral showpieces impressed the impresario Serge Diaghilev, whose company, the Ballet Russe, was one of the artistic leading lights of its day. His previous season of ballets had been praised for its dance and its design, but criticised for its lack of musical novelty, so Diaghilev decided to answer this by commissioning new music for a ballet of the most typically exotic Russian fairy tale he could think of, The Firebird. The composer he tried first, Gliadov, who was renowned for taking forever to write anything, just couldn't get started. So, with time pressing, Diaghilev took a real gamble and approached the young Stravinsky. He wrote the music just a few months, and the ballet's first performance was a tremendous success. It was a sensational debut for Stravinsky himself, in music of astonishing orchestral virtuosity, rhythmic subtlety and drive, which made him a household name overnight. More often, we just get to hear one of the various orchestral suites of selected highlights from the music, but Thierry Fisher believes it's so much better to have the whole ballet.
I've decided a few years ago that I don't like suites anymore. I don't know why. I just prefer the complete story. I know it's ballet music, and anyway, we're missing the dancers. But I don't miss them in my mind. I just think the concept is clearer if we play the whole piece.
We tend to think of the next two Stravinsky ballets as being the groundbreakers, Petrushka and, of course, particularly, I suppose, Rite of Spring. What is there new in The Firebird in orchestral terms?
I think it's this new surrealistic, impressionistic way of orchestrating, because you can hear a lot of French influences, and still it's incredibly Russian in terms of the mythology, but the amazing colorful orchestra texture is what inspires me the most in this piece.
Well, as for the story of the ballet, the green taloned demon Kashchei is the embodiment of evil. Anyone who enters his enchanted kingdom is in danger. Maidens are held captive, men are turned to stone. Kashchei stays immortal so long as his soul, in the shape of an egg preserved in a casket, remains unharmed. A young prince wanders into the kingdom, drawn there by the dazzling plumage of the mysterious firebird who he captures. When he releases the bird, he's given a magic feather, and eventually he remembers he can use it to summon the firebird to help him. He sets the princess is free from the spell cast over them by Kashchei by smashing the egg and thus killing the demon. And the prince can then, of course, marry the most beautiful of the princesses. And here comes Thierry Fisher joining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales on the Royal Albert Hall platform to perform Stravinsky's ballet, Complete, The Firebird.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so the evil demon Castche is vanquished with the help of the Firebird, and the prince can marry his princess. Stravinsky's ballet The Firebird, brought to life in all its picture book colours here in the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, leader Leslie Hatfield, with its principal conductor Thierry Fisher. Well, the orchestration, as you heard in that original version of the score, is just sumptuous. Stravinsky first said he was more proud of that than the music itself, and then he even criticised that aspect. And the orchestration was wastefully large. Three harps, piano, celesta, quadruple wind, battery of percussion. And tonight we had trumpets up in the gallery, real surround sound, four Wagner tubas just off stage. And that yell had to be for the principal horn, Tim Thorpe. Wonderful solo in the last movement there, taking it back to a whisper, and the entire woodwind section being brought to their feet. And the five percussionists, and Steve Bannard, the principal timpanist, and the brass, of course. Well, Terry Fisher, after another concert or two, has got a three-week holiday in Provence. He's looking forward to that then, with his new orchestra, the Utor Symphony, which is music director Beethoven 9, the Berlioz Requiem, then back to Wales to start their season with Beethoven 9 and Adam's Transmigration of the Souls for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. At Christmas, Berlioz's L'Enfance du Christ, always a speciality of Thierry Fisher. And July, a tour of China, including Strauss's Alpine Symphony. A farewell to the orchestra at the Proms. If you've missed part of this evening's concert, or you'd like to hear it again, it's available, of course, for a week on the BBC iPlayer, and it'll be repeated this Friday afternoon very soon at 2 here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. Thierry Fisher back on the platform. What a reception, bringing the orchestra to its feet. Well, we'll be back live here at the Albert Hall at 10 this evening as the BBC Radio 3 World Roots Academy visits India. And tomorrow evening, as I said, at 7 o'clock, Thierry Fisher and his orchestra back on stage for what promises to be a fascinating evening's music making, Beethoven Symphonies 1 and 7, the bookends, in between the wonderful Emmanuel Pailloux, the soloist, in two new flute concertos, the London premiere of Marc-André Dalbavy's tender, colourful piece, and the UK premiere of the dazzling work written by the then 99-year-old Elliot Carter. But as Thierry Fisher returns to the stomping of the promenaders, time to head to Broadcasting House for a breather between all the adrenaline of live concerts as I hand you on into the care of Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much. Martin Hanby there at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, at 9:15, which is in about 10 minutes' time, we'll hear the composer portrait, a portrait of the composer we just heard in the prom, Pascal Dussapin. He'll be talking to Andrew McGregor about his music, and that's actually an event that happened this afternoon. So, until 9:15, let's hear some French piano music. Here is Pascal Roger playing Debussy's Two Arabesques. Pascal Roger was playing Debussy's two arabesques. Well, it's time for one more piece by Debussy. Here's Puck's Dance from the First Book of Preludes. Puck's Dance by Debussy from his First Book of Preludes. The pianist was Pascal Roger. At 10 o'clock this evening, we go back to the Royal Albert Hall in London for the 2011 World Roots Academy. We'll be hearing the singer Aruna Sairam and her protege, London-born veena player Hari Sivanesan. BBC Radio 3, it's 9:15, and tonight's composer portrait is introduced by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music, just across the way from the Royal Albert Hall, where we've come to meet composer Pascal Dussapin and find out a bit more about the way he thinks about his music and the way he writes something like, for instance, the sixth quartet Hinterland from this evening's prom. And we're also going to hear Pascal's trio Rombach performed for us right here by students from the Guildhall School of Music in London. Now, Pascal, as a young man, you were, as many others were, part of Olivier Messiaen's classes at the Paris Conservatoire. Your early teachers included Yannis Xenakis and Franco Donatoni. Yet you say you're not a theorist. How does that work?
Yes, in fact, you know, I have to be honest with Olivier Messiaen because I studied 1 year with him at the conservatory, but after 1 year I left the class because I was a little bit savage, you know, and it was impossible for me to understand anything about Olivier Messiaen. Of course, I have a huge admiration of him, you know, and for this reason, I have the habit to yes, in a sense, to be honest and to tell. And no, I'm not a student, a real student of Olivier Messiaen. But the reality is, in the same times I was a student of Xenakis at the university, it was really my real place, you know, my right place. And but Xenakis for me was a fantastic person also today, because he was not a teacher. He was not my teacher. And but he was a master. That's the difference. And I didn't want to have teachers. You know, I was absolutely traumatized about teachers, you know, for all. When I was 18, you know, I was totally crazy about teachers, you know. I was always refusing everything, you know, about them. Xenakis, he asked me nothing. He had no interest about me. And I was just, I wanted just to hear him. And I did it. And after 2 years, he asked me, you are really courageous, you. Who are you?
But did you know by then? Because, you know, you've gone to work with or sit at the feet of somebody who's famous for structure, for
yes.
Mathematical yes, techniques, architecture, all of those things. And it seems to be the opposite of so much of what you do.
Yes, but not. The reality is I studied a lot the theory of Xenakis. You know, in the same times I was a little bit in the conservatory, of course, and also I began architecture, you know. And for this reason, I totally dropped, in a sense, many ways to structure the world, in a sense, you know. And also today, I'm always trying and to using, is it correct, you know, to many elements of. I wrote a book about that, you know, but in French. I'm sorry. And but the reality for me is. It's for me, it's important to not divide the world of the intuition, the imagination, the world of the pure decisions, and the world of how to build something. You know, if you need some other structures, for example, mathematical, you know, to make and to build the music. It's the same gesture for me. I have no separation in my brain about, yes, I want that. Okay, I take it without to explain something. It's just a choice. And after, if I need a group theory to organize some, for example, in the trio you will hear, you know, in some minutes, you know, the second movement is based with on a numeric rapport, very, very precise, you know, but it's not necessary to know it, you know, exactly. And for this reason, in France, and maybe in some other country, the people know I am just an intuitive guy, you know. But I think the intuition, it's the most beautiful part of the human being. And to be intuitive, it's a real job, and you have to think about that too.
And you had a background in jazz quite early on as well.
Yes,
that immediately separates you from the world of the classical establishment at the time that you were a student.
Yeah,
it? Because you know you had to be approved to be a composer. This is the world of Pierre Boulez and Ercan.
Oh yes, that's the French context, you know. But now it's totally changed. But when I was young, of course, my culture was classical. I was an organist, you know. I tried to be an organist and before a pianist, and my world was Jean-Sébastien Bach and Beethoven, you know, especially Bach and Beethoven, you know. But I was a teenager too, you know. I was not totally out of the world, and in fact, when I was 15, you know, I was listening to the music of many English groups, generally. but it was a different period, very experimental, you know. For example, if you consider some aspect of the Pink Floyd music, of some Beatles music, you know, some part, it's very experimental. It was the way. I learned many things with this music too, you know. I have to confess that, you know. But after some time with this kind of music, playing Bach and Beethoven too, you know, I discovered the jazz, especially the some part of the free jazz. I was really interested about the crazy music, you know, and I tried to become a jazz musician. I play a lot, you know, jazz music, and some parts of my music come really deeply, not from the jazz, but from some articulation, from specific articulation, and but it's impossible to hear exactly, you know.
And, but it's also impossible to separate this from your personality.
Yes, of course. And that's true in this period, in the 70s, 80s, you know, the world about the contemporary music was really hierarchic. It's this is the French complex, you know, this obsession to reconduct always the elite system, you know. You must be just an extraction of the big school. You must be the best, the most brilliant person, you know. And I was not like that, you know. I was like an immigrated, you know, around the border, the corners, you know, of the music. And I wanted to be like that. Of course, I understood that after years and years. And for this reason, today, I'm always trying to explain to the people or to some students, because I was teacher at the Musikhochschule in Munich in Germany, to be open, you know. It's possible to become richer and richer with the others' music, you know. And in France, in those years, you know, it was like an army. It was very ideological, you know. It was those people know they get the truth. And this is a mistake, as you know. Of course, my tradition is classical. You know, I love to write for a symphonic orchestra and stuff like that. But it's possible to take something in the East music, in the pop music, in the jazz music, and etc. etc. But now the situation, especially for young people, is totally different. You know.
But we're going to hear, I know, in the Trio Rombach, which is the piece that the trio is going to play for, is elements of some of that Eastern European music, and also maybe some elements of jazz or blues.
Yeah.
Certainly. But shall we talk about just briefly about the title, Trio Rombach, because it's from January 1997. It was commissioned by the International Academy of the Music of Maurice Ravel for its anniversary. So does the Ravel Piano Trio, which has some jazz influence,
Yes, of course. But before to explain the title, you know, this piece, for me, it's very important, because during years and years, I was always refusing the piano. I didn't want to write for the piano. For me, it was just a forbidden instrument, you know. But in the 96, when 95 maybe, because it's necessary to take time to work to realize the commission, this Ravel Academy wanted a trio, you know, with piano. And at the beginning, I refused. And after, sometimes I thought, yes, but maybe it could be great to introduce for the first time the piano in my music, you know. And I did it. And for this reason, the first notes you will hear, you know, it's just the notes, the first note I wrote for the piano. And in the context of this composition, was a little bit not sad, of course, because that's life, but I was really close to a person, André Boukourechev. He was a composer and also a musicologist. He wrote many books about music, but Schumann, Beethoven, Stravinsky, and about the language, musical language. I knew him very young. He helped me many times when I was really young. And his name was André Boukourechev. He was from Bulgaria. Installed in Paris since, you know, 30, 40 years, you know, when. But he was, unfortunately, he was dying. And I wanted to offer to him a tribute. And for this reason, a secret tribute, for secret, you know. such a secret tribute, but with the music inventing a color, a specific color about the East, the Mitteleuropa, you know, Eastern music. That the reality is I'm very attracted, I have a passion for this music. And when I was really young, when I discovered Janáček, for example, but he was quasi forbidden in some zones of the contemporary music, Janáček in the 70s, 80s. It was absolutely stupid, of course, but it was like that, you know. It was this kind of composer wasn't the mainstream of the whole Europe, you know. But what about the Europe today, you know? The Europe, it's just the world, you know. But in the 70s, the Europe, it was just 3-4 countries, you know, and with the bad guys, it was the Russian, and the good guys was America, you know. And we were with music between, of course, the big Schoenberg, Webern, etc., Darmstadt, the Nauschingen, and it was like a church, you know. But Janáček, for example, it didn't work in this mainstream, you know, something. And some other composers, as Sibelius, for example, you know. And I wanted to get into my music this character, this color, to think the problem, theoretically speaking. And I invent some scales, some melodies, some effects, you know, and I made such a catalogue not effect, of course, but it was a huge exercise for me, you know. For this reason, this trio seemed sometimes close to a very old culture, you know, from the east of the
world. I kept hearing sort of gypsy music and Hungarian folk dances, elements of Bartok string quartets seem to be there.
Because
it'd be interesting to hear what
the deduce music, you know, are always going through me. I'm totally traversed by many, many music, and I am a reconductor of all those influence, you know.
But also that idea of it being a lament for a friend as well, and there's the feeling of blues about so much.
Yes, because but maybe it's unconscious, you know, because it's my culture too. And for example, in the piece we heard there in the Royal the last week, you know, at the Royal Albert Hall, you know, I wrote like a dance to the end, you know. It was 5-6 minutes. The orchestra, it's like it's dancing. But it's a theoretical problem, how it's possible to inject a dance today in a contemporary music, you know. But to do that for maybe some people, you know, was there, and to do that, it's necessary to have the culture of that, you know. And my culture was some elements of the jazz, and for this reason, I'm going in my brain in very like in a baby remember, you know? So something like that, you know, and
early memories.
About the title, it's very simple. The title Rombach is just the name of a village, you know, in the east of the France. And I was there with a friend, you know. He's clarinetist, you know, and I was correcting the manuscript, you know, the copy, you know, for the edition, for my publisher, you know, and he took the score and he adapted it for clarinet. For this reason, it exists the same version, but with a clarinet, without violin, and in a clarinet, it works well.
So this is named after the place.
Yes,
it's stolen
and I was looking a title, you know, looking for a title, and it was so fun because it's a very nice friend of me, you know, and I thought just well, Trio Rombach, it sounds well, you know, but now it's bizarre because many people are always thinking more complex thing. No, it's very simple. It's just a title of a little village, you know, with 3 or 4 houses. And for example, I had an American article about this Trio Rombach, where the guy, you know, found the solution. It was something between the ROM about the computer memory. That's true,
and,
huh?
And Bach. Of course. You know.
It was so fun. Yeah.
But well, we've got just a couple of minutes for you to introduce us to the work before we hear it. So I was wondering about what sort of journey we go on here, because I know that you haven't had for you the journey is important, more than the structure, the journey, the travel, the...
Of course, the, of course,
the journey. And the events that happen while we're on this journey. But when the trio was rehearsing this afternoon, and they were in the middle of the second movement, and you were saying, look, it must be like a discussion. And these are different characters. Mm.
Yes, of course, because maybe it's like... I'm sorry, it's a little bit egocentric, but I can just feel the situations like that, you know. When I'm writing music, for me, it's like it's like a vocality, you know. It's like words, and of course, at last, it's like a theater. And sometimes, when I'm rehearsing with musicians, I like to be very, in a sense, precise, but also very a little bit metaphoric, to explain the music quickly to the musician. And it's very efficient to explain them with the theater of the music, you know, inside the music. It exists, for example, and you have just three musicians, but it's like a trio, you know. But what about the emotion, you know, of course? The emotion should be also to be worried sometimes, but to be worried in a different sense, you know, to go up after this anxiety, you know, this fear a little bit.
Exactly. There is quite a lot of anxiety in here. There's the character of the lament.
Yeah.
There's a lot of adrenaline and excitement and busyness, as we'll hear. There are a lot of sort of stabs and sudden, almost percussive elements. And it's unsettling in a sense because it rotates around the same interval the whole time, doesn't it? There's a tritone and augmented fourth.
Yeah.
A lot, so it never settles into a key. Mm. Does the piece have a resolution for you? Because right at the end, it doesn't sort of settle into one key upwards or downwards. It
a just resolution, sort of you mean, what kind?
Maybe of emotional resolution, but does it need to resolve for you? Because it just seems to vanish.
No, because, yes, of course, that's true. It's a very important question, in fact. But to know exactly the religion, I would like to be honest with that, because to know exactly if it's possible to resolve something, it's necessary to die. Yes, because after when you are dead, the universe you construct is constituent. And you know, for example, if you consider the work of Anton Webern, for example, or Samuel Beckett, you can have a point of view because you can consider the all the inventions he invented, but he's dead. It's possible to understand a little, for Beckett too, for every artist important like that. And fortunately, I'm not dead.
Work in progress.
Yes. I'm sorry, it's a little bit heavy what I was, but that's true, you know. And I'm never finishing a piece. I'm always continuing something, you know. When I wrote this piece in 96, 97, you know, I finished and I was immediately in another piece, you know. But the process continues, you know, it's always like that. It doesn't matter the format of the piece. For me to write an opera and after a piece for a clarinet solo, of course it's not the same ambition, but something can go in and to go through, and for this reason it's impossible to answer really well to you, you know.
Well, I think that was a pretty good attempt at an answer. And also yes, of course. It's a fascinating ending to the piece as well, for that very reason, as I think we're going to hear. So, well, we've talked quite a bit about it. We're about to hear Pascal Dussopin's Trio Rombach, so please welcome the performers who've been rehearsing it this afternoon with Pascal, mainly in French, from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, violinist Marco Popristov, cellist William Amber, and pianist Thomas Bernard. Trio Rombach from 1997 by Pascal Dussopin, played by our trio from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, violinist Marco Popristoff, cellist William Amber, and pianist Thomas Bernard. And thanks to them for their devotion and dedication. I'm sure they learned quite a lot from their rehearsal this afternoon with Pascal. And I hope we all have from hearing him talk about his music. Thanks to the Royal College of Music for hosting this Proms Plus Composer Portrait. The next one is Thursday, the 18th of August, when I'll be talking to Thomas Lacher about his new work and hearing some of his chamber music as well. Until then, thanks to our audience here in the Amaryllis Fleming Hall for joining us. Thanks to our radio audience for listening. And most of all to Pascal Dussopin for telling us so much about what makes his music tick. Thank you.
That was Andrew McGregor, and that programme was recorded earlier this afternoon. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Coming up at 11.30, Max Reinhardt presents tonight's Late Junction. But now, live from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall here in London, here's Lucy Duran with the second of this evening's proms.
Good evening and welcome to this World Roots Academy Late Night Prom. I'm Lucy Duran, and I present the weekly programme on Radio 3 called World Roots. Thank you very much. Tonight's concert showcases two wonderful musicians from the Carnatic classical tradition of South India. One hails from Greenwich in South London, though his roots are in Sri Lanka. He's a young, up-and-coming player of the veena, which is a very ancient member of the lute family. It's the ancestor of the sitar, and nothing sounds quite like it. The other musician has flown here specially for the prom, all the way from Chennai in South India, where she lives. She's one of the greatest Carnatic singers of today. She has a sublime voice with an astonishing vocal range and a unique repertoire. These two performers are from very different backgrounds and are at very different stages in their career. They've been brought together by Radio 3's World Roots Academy, a scheme that pairs a UK protégé with a mentor who's an internationally renowned artist from the same musical culture. And so, over the past few months, World Roots has followed our 2011 protégé from the Tamil communities in London, where he grew up, to Tamil Nadu in South India, the land of temples, where he met his mentor for the first time, and then onwards to the war-torn north of Sri Lanka. It's been an incredible experience, often very moving, and always with wonderful music. You may have heard some of this on World Roots over the past few weeks. And one of my favorite moments was when we visited the small shrine, or samadhi, of the great South Indian composer, the Saint Tyagaraja, next to a dry riverbed on a boiling hot day. Protégé and mentor performed together for the first time to a somewhat random audience of priests, visitors, the Radio 3 team, and a group of rather surprised cricket players. But I can assure you that the voice and the veena are a duo made in heaven. Tonight is the very first time that a prom has focused entirely on the Carnatic tradition, and we're extremely fortunate to be joined by the World Roots Academy 2011 mentor, who will shortly be on stage, the great singer Aruna Sairam. But first, I'd like to welcome this year's protege, all the way from South London, Harry Sivanesan.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Welcome. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real privilege for us to be here for the first Carnatic BBC prom. May there be many more. So, the first piece was a composition of Saint Thyagaraja, who Lucy mentioned earlier. It's written in praise of Lord Rama, his chosen deity, and set in Raga Nalinakanti and Tala Adi, entitled Manavyala Kincharadate. As you know, my roots and also Prasanna's roots are here in London. We learnt at the Bhavan. I learnt from my teacher, Srimati Sivasakti Sivanesan. And this guru-shishya relationship, I suppose, is something that's very special in Carnatic music, because the composition that I played today was passed down from guru to pupil, who then became a guru to pupil, guru to pupil, and that's how the music has stayed on. So from these roots, I have to thank the World Roots team, because they've really taken me on a huge, huge journey. Not only musically, spiritually, they've taken me back to my roots in Jaffna. And also practically and logistically, the year's been a real roller coaster. But part of that year, the most important part of that year was the mentee, was the mentor. And they've asked me to say something about Arunah Sairam, Arunah Ji, my mentor. It's really hard to encapsulate her. She is a phenomenon on stage, and she has this ability to express just through a single note any feeling that she wants you to feel. And apart from as a stage performer, just spending time with her, which I was very privileged to do when we were in Chennai, every moment there was something for me to learn. Even while I was just standing on the wings about to come in, she told me something that her teacher had told her just before she was about to come on stage. And it's really these gems that I really have to thank her for. So it gives me great, great, immense privilege. And I'd please ask you to warmly, warmly welcome Srimati Arunah Sairam to stage.
Tulakil kapali charatan tulkarti gaina talatte Thank you.
Jagan Mohan, Yellorukum vanakkam. A very good evening to all of you. Yesterday, as I was speaking to someone, they asked me, they said, "Can you tell us what is Carnatic music in one sentence?" And all I could think of telling them was, this is music that celebrates life in all its colors and all its emotions. It is not very contemplative or introspective all the time. It sometimes is also that, but by and large, the sum and substance of the effect of this form of classical music of South India is that it takes you, embraces all of us as we are today in life, doing so much and yet trying to get little drops of happiness here and there. And this is what this music tries to give us. So I do hope you enjoy this evening with all of us. And the piece that I sang was in a raga called Mohanam. The earlier long drawn out introduction was by a poet, Thirignana Sambandar, from the 12th century. And that was followed by a piece from the last century. So we sort of spanned the history of the composition of Carnatic music in that little suite that we presented. It's a pleasure to be a part of the World Roots Academy, to be a mentor to Hari, who is so talented, and he's been working so wonderfully and with so much commitment the last 6 months. It's been a pleasure to know him. We're going to now present a three-part suite, which actually in a full-length concert would take an hour and a half by itself. But we're going to abridge it and give it to you in a short time. Time is the essence, as we know. And the first part will have an alap, which is like a, you know, like an air. It just dreamily goes through the scale and explores the different possibilities in that scale. And then we do a thanam, and this thanam is really, in the first part, Jyotsna ji and I will work together, and in the thanam, which is really actually a mainstay of the veena, I think it emanated from the veena and was later borrowed by the voice. So we're going to do with Hari a thanam, which is like a quasi-rhythmical section, and then we have a full-fledged refrain with all the percussionists coming in, and then of course, as always, we go from one emotion to another, and the final thing is always a climactic, you know, ending where all of us are like ready to, you know, let ourselves go, kind of, and also tagged by a percussion little ensemble by itself.
La 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 Oh.
dum da nom dum 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 da nom dum 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 da da dum 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 da da nom da nom da ya ya nom da ya nom da nom da nom dum da da dum da dum da dum dum da dum
No.
Thank you for the gift. We continue with the third part of this piece. Vele panivadeyal